You have described capital as finance and only finance, and this would seem to be an explicit inversion of Marx, who considered finance to be fictitious capital. Can you describe the role of finance in capitalism?
Let's begin with Marx first, so we know where the differences lie. Marx differentiated between two types of capital. He spoke about actual capital and fictitious capital. Actual capital was an objective entity. It consisted of commodity. It was made of machines, raw materials, work in progress, inventories, and of course commodity money too. And actual capital in Marx is backward looking to actual cost. So you examine its magnitude by looking at how much it took to produce in terms of labor time. Fictitious capital in Marx is a different entity. It's subjective, and it's defined as capitalization. In other words, it's defined as the discounting to present value of expected future earnings. So in that sense, it looks not backward, it looks forward. It looks forward to the expected earnings. Now, these are very, very different types of capital, and in Marx, they play extremely different roles. There's no question that the key in Marx is actual capital. In other words, the objective entity consisting of commodities. And that entity is measured in units of socially necessary abstract labor time. And this unit is, for Marx, the anchor of the economic process. And consequently, it's also the anchor of the entire mode of production. So actual capital in Marx is really at the center. Now, fictitious capital is a secondary entity. It can have a large impact, and Marxists recently have paid quite a bit of attention to that impact. But this impact is limited in two ways. First, it's mostly negative. So fictitious capital is largely a distortion of the behavior of actual capital. It interferes with it, either positively or negatively. And secondly, it's short-term in nature. In other words, the trajectory of fictitious capital oscillates around the trajectory of actual capital rather than vice versa. Now, this context that Marx develops of these two entities, actual and fictitious capital, has to be understood historically. When Marx was writing, there were no national accounts such as we have today. There were no organized statistical apparatuses. There were some statistics, but there were not anything similar to what we have right now. And the number of data sources was minuscule in comparison to the present. And in that context, most political economists, Marx included, didn't really think that they needed to examine, and certainly they didn't think they needed to prove their point by measurement. So they would make a theoretical point. Occasionally they will illustrate it by some data, sometimes hypothetical, sometimes actual. But that was pretty much it. Since the time that Marx wrote, the situation completely inverted. We now have data that are coming out of our ears. And this abundance of data allows us to conclude quite definitively, I think, that what Marx called actual capital, in fact, is a fiction, because we do not know what socially necessary abstract labor time is, and therefore we cannot measure that actual capital and cannot actually prove that it exists in a material, quantitative, definitive magnitude. In fact, it's much more serious than that. During the 1950s, there was a very famous, infamous, in fact, debate that most economists prefer to forget. It was called the Cambridge Controversy. It was a debate between Cambridge, England, where most of the critics lived, and this is Cambridge University, and Cambridge, U.S., where the defenders of the neoclassical notion of capital were concentrated. And this debate was on the notion of whether capital existed as a material entity. And the conclusion of that debate, which was largely based on logical argument, was that there is no such thing as an objective entity called the capital stock. And that conclusion was accepted by most of the neoclassical participants, including a few Nobel laureates. So both analytically, I think, and empirically, in the current world that we live right now, Marx must be put on his head. In other words, the actual capital that he speaks about is a fictitious entity. It's an entity that we cannot define and measure. Whereas the fictitious capital he talks about is, in fact, the real thing. Finance has a unique value. It's observable at every second. And it certainly dominates the world. It dominates the way capitalists behave. It dominates the world, the way governments behave. And it dominates the obedience of the rest of the population completely. So you can argue that we need to switch roles between fictitious and actual capital. Now, from this viewpoint, I think that the fact that Marxists, or at least most Marxists, continue to distinguish between actual and fictitious capital is really a tragic reproduction of a basic misconception. And that reproduction took various forms over the past century. It started with Rudolf Hilferding's notion of finance capital. Hilferding was a German political economist, Marxist, who concentrated on the institutional and political takeover of industry by financial interests, as he saw them. And he concentrated also on what that takeover implied for the emergence of authoritarian domestic and foreign policy. So that was kind of the first turn that the notion of fictitious capital took. And then this notion took a new turn with the emergence of the theories of monopoly capital by Baran and Sweezy, who started to argue that finance was, in fact, a form of absorbing the rising surplus of industry. So this is another understanding of what fictitious capital consists of. And then it culminated more recently with scholars such as Giovanni Arrighi and Michael Hudson and others who have been speaking about the transition from industry to finance and the so-called process of financialization, a process that, if you like, eviscerates the productive base of society. So this transformation is very destructive of the ability of capitalism to reproduce itself. Now, all of these variants, going back to the turn of the 20th century, share, I think, one feature that in our view is erroneous, and that is that they all assume that there exists a true productive capital and that the monetary appearance of finance deviates from this productive capital and distorts it. So that's common to all of these different interpretations of the division between actual and financial capital. Now, in our view, the setup is very different. For us, finance is not a fiction and it's not a distortion. Finance is the real thing. Finance is really the engine that runs the capitalist mega machine. Modern finance operates through the ritual of capitalization. And this ritual of capitalization constitutes the organizing principle, the algorithm, the basic algorithm of capitalism, if you will. What is this capitalization ritual? Well, the essence of this process is the discounting to present value of so-called risk-adjusted expected future earnings. And again, this is something Marx acknowledged. He just gave it a secondary importance. What does this ritual consist of? In our work, we argue that there are four basic components, or elementary particles, to this ritual. And they consist of future earnings, of the hype or the excessive pessimism or optimism of capitalists when they predict those future earnings. It consists of perceptions of risks, of risk that capitalists have, and it consists of the normal rate of return. Now, I'm not going to go into an analytical description of this ritual, but I'll try to illustrate it in an abstract way with some example. suppose that capitalists expect Exxon, a share of Exxon, a single share of Exxon, to generate $100 annually, year in, year out. Now, of course, this is not a realistic assumption because the generation of profit fluctuates over time, but for the sake of illustration, that will do. Now, what the capitalist will then try to do is calculate how much this flow of profit of $100 annually is worth at a given discount rate, say 20%. Now, if this flow is expected to go on indefinitely, the share should be worth for them $500. So if you tell them the rate of return is 20% right now, or the discount rate is 20%, you expect $100 year in, year out as a profit, how much you will are you willing to pay for that arrangement? The answer would be $500. And why? Because if you invest $500 and you receive $100 annually, that represents a return of 20%. So the price of capital essentially is a reflection of what you expect to get and what discount rate you're using in order to complete the computation. Now, the discount rate itself comprises two components. The first is the so-called normal rate of return. In other words, the rate of return that capitalists expect to get with the lowest possible risk. And it consists of another factor, which is the risk factor. And that is the fear that they have regarding the particular asset that they acquire. For example, if the normal rate of return, for instance, the rate of return on Swiss government bonds, which is fairly secure, say it is 5%. And if the risk of an Exxon share is deemed to be four times larger, and again, this is partly subjective, partly objective, capitalists think it's four times higher, then the discount rate will be four times 5%, in other words, 20%. So this more or less is kind of the basic principle underlying the ritual of capitalization. The important thing about this ritual is that it's not just a sort of a financial mechanism. This is an all-encompassing algorithm. This is something that engulfs society. Every one of the four elementary particles of capitalization, future earnings, hype, risk, and the normal rate of return, is affected by the underlying processes of power in capitalism. And once these particles are recorded in capitalized value, the underlying processes that affect them become part and parcel of capital. Again, example. If, say, the war in the Middle East, in Iraq, is expected to raise the earnings of the oil and the armament companies, and that in turn affects the capitalization of those companies, then war, that particular war, becomes an aspect of their capital, obviously. Or let me give you another illustration. Suppose there is a massive relaxation of intellectual property rights that reduces the earnings of Microsoft, because without property rights, everybody can copy those pieces of software for practically nothing. So it reduces the earnings of Microsoft, and it raises their volatility, and therefore it raises their risk. So you have lower earning, higher risk, and obviously Microsoft capitalization, which is now in the vicinity of, say, $300 billion, will become much lower. So in that sense, the relaxation of intellectual property rights becomes part and parcel of the capitalization of Microsoft and therefore of Microsoft's capital. Or, say, think of the subsidization of education that improves the profits of high-tech firms more than other firms. So that subsidy becomes a differential part of their capital. Or think about religion. You know, Desmond Tutu is reputed to have said that when the whites came to South Africa, they had the Bible and the blacks had the land, and now it's the opposite. The blacks have the Bible and the whites have the land. The effect of religion in South Africa has been, at least one of the effects, to pacify the labor force, to make it more obedient, more docile. And that, of course, has an impact on earning capacity of firms. It increases the earnings of firms, and it reduces their volatility. And once this effect gets capitalized, it becomes part of capital. So in that way, religion has become part of the capital of South African companies. And of course, we can give more and more examples of that type. All of them suggest that capital itself encompasses institutions of power. Once those institutions and the impact of them on capital get capitalized. Now, I think that it's important to emphasize here that this ritual of capitalization, which again, as you can see, is far larger than merely a matter of finance and corporate finance, and the extent to which this ritual encompassed and internalized other processes of power is not a natural process. There's nothing automatic about it. In fact, this ritual has a very definite historical progression. It first began in the European Burgs of probably the 14th century. It was adopted more systematically by English bankers in the 17th century, around the time of the Glorious Revolution, when religious opposition to usury started to be relaxed. For the next couple of centuries, it was based mostly on rules of thumb, but during the middle of the 19th century, we see for the first time the evolution of detailed calculations, and the first to actually develop those calculations were German foresters that examined the cost-benefit considerations of forestry. The ideological foundations of capitalization were laid down around the turn of the 20th century by the American economist Irving Fisher, who developed it theoretically, and they were popularized by Benjamin Graham and David Dodd, who wrote the major text on finance. Subsequently, these principles started to penetrate finance textbooks, and that happened around the middle of the 20th century. And from then on, capitalization started to be the major consideration in the way assets are priced and in the way corporations compute their budgets. And you can say that in the late 20th century, the principles of capitalization spread over the entire globe. And in fact, judging by the number of people who follow those principles, they became the world's largest religion because they have more followers than all of the other religions combined. So what I'm suggesting here is that there is no distortion here. Finance has grown not as some sort of an external shock or an internal parasite that distorts and eviscerates something that is of a nature of true capital. It doesn't exist as a negation of the true nature of capitalism. Instead, we have here a gradual process, I think, by which finance, which in our opinion is the only form capital assumed from the very beginning, so the process is one in which finance slowly penetrates, slowly incorporates, slowly creates more and more power aspects of capitalist society, gives them shape, and controls them. From this viewpoint, to understand capitalism means to juxtapose the quantitative process of differential capitalization, on the one hand, with the qualitative power processes that underlie this capitalization, on the other. So in that sense, I think capital is finance and only finance, from a quantitative perspective, and we have to understand the qualitative features of that finance in the broadest possible way, not just as part of economics and not just as a reflection of some real thing, but as the creation of a power order that we call capitalism, and that is the qualitative side of it.